Hello, comic book fans. Welcome to episode 46 of Comic Review Weekly, the podcast where you get the lowdown on comic books, hosted by me, Andy Slaughter. Comic Review Weekly is brought to you by the folks at Gravy Boy, the comic for people who like a little hero and their superheroes. Check it out at www.gravyboy.com. Well, today we have a special treat. You know, it's getting close to Halloween, so I thought it'd be nice to do a horror-themed Comic Review Weekly. So today, we're going to look at some of the history and classic comics of EC Comics. Now, some of you, most of you probably know EC, also known as Entertaining Comics, printed stuff in the 40s and the 50s, like crime suspense stories, Tales from the Crypt, Haunt of Fear, Weird Science, Weird Fantasy, all that kind of stuff. Well, we're mainly going to look at the horror books today, the three of them, which the three of them were The Vault of Horror, Tales from the Crypt, and The Haunt of Fear. So where did it all start? Well, Entertaining Comics had been printing stuff, mostly crime stories and romance comics, for years. And then, in 1947, Bill Gaines inherited EC from his father. Later on, titles like War Against Crime and Crime Patrol were replaced by Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt. However, these weren't the first horror comics, but the first ones came, I think, in the mid-40s. But they did set off a trend that many companies would follow. So yeah, these were the big three in terms of horror comics: Vault of Horror, Tales from the Crypt, and Haunt of Fear. This led to increased publication of horror titles and competition among different companies. This competition led to gorier stories, because everybody was trying to outdo each other, trying to be the goriest. You know, the covers would show this. If you've ever seen the covers of these reprints, you would really wonder. At least the uncensored versions, you would really wonder how they ever saw the light of day. Even today, some of them are still pretty gruesome, but I'll get to that more later. Anyway, the point is, this this increased gruesomeness drew the attention of parents, politicians, and most notably Dr. Frederick Wertham, which many of you will probably know in his book Attack. What is it? What's the name?
Seduction of the Innocent.
Thank you. Seduction of the Innocent. He basically drew parallels between every kind of evil you could think of: crime, pornography, child porn, whatever, the worst things you could think of. Frederick Wertham drew parallels to these and comic books. He basically said, you know, this is where this comes from, the comic books. The kids see the comic books, so that's why we have these societal problems. That's why we have juvenile delinquents. Well, a lot of people believed him, and this led to the creation of the comic book code. You know, what it says when it's spelled out, but it's the comics code that led to extra censorship and only certain kinds of stories seeing the print. Now, let's keep in mind, EC wasn't single-handedly responsible for this, but it really, I mean, I'm looking at this stuff now, and I have to say, it really led the charge, and you're going to see why once I talk about some of these books. Now, many companies, when the Comics Code was started up and Seduction of the Innocent was published, well, they went out of business. People stopped buying them, and they were hounded by the government and all kinds of stuff. But they went out of business, and luckily, EC stayed in business by becoming what we all know today as Mad Magazine. But the point of this show isn't to really give you a detailed history, but to kind of discuss what was the big deal about these books? Why did kids love these things so much? I mean, you know, you think about kids and I'm a parent too, and they love to look at what they're not supposed to or what they think adults don't want them to see. And so here we have magazines that are, well, they were aimed at children, but they featured gruesome, horrifying acts, and it's pretty crazy. So, let's see. The first story, I want to look at is, and I have to tell you, I'm looking at these from the 1990s reprints that were put out by Gladstone Comics. I don't have any of the originals. The originals. I don't even know how much you can buy them for now. I mean, at Comic Cons, you find the Silver Age guys selling them probably at least a few hundred dollars for some of these copies, depending on their condition. I'm sure there were book burnings that went on, so that affects their value. But one of the stories is called Till Death. It's from the Vault of Horror. And, you know, just like in the Tales from the Crypt TV show, at the beginning of these comic books, they always have some old witch going, hee-hee-hee, welcome, kiddies! You know, that sort of... Tales from the Crypt! That sort of thing. And it's kind of cheesy, but... anyway, so in this story, a rich plantation owner brings his fiancée from the United States to his new home deep in a Caribbean jungle. And for neighbors, I guess they're either his slaves or his neighbors or something. But of course, they're into voodoo. You know, they stage little voodoo ritual dances for him and his wife and all kinds of stuff. So eventually, the wife gets a bad case of jungle fever. Sorry. That's not where she has an interracial affair. But she literally gets sick from something in the jungle. And she dies. Well, sorry. Okay. Anyway, when the natives see this, they watch the owner lose all of his, the landowner lose all of his happiness. So they want to see him happy again. I guess he's nice to them. So they want to see him happy again. So they decide to raise his wife from the dead with their voodoo power. Well, she returns to life, and for a few days, he is happy. For a few days, because she's not exactly the same. It doesn't seem... It's kind of weird in the comic book, because she comes back from the dead, and he's happy, but she doesn't seem to say anything. She just kind of stares off blankly. So, you know, maybe that is some men's idea of happiness, having a wife that doesn't talk. But as time goes on... she decays and decays and decays until she's nothing more than a rotting corpse following him around. He tries shooting her, suffocating her, drowning her, getting in a helicopter and tossing her deep into the jungle several days away with the hopes that something will get rid of her. Because, yeah, I mean, you can't live with a corpse, you know. So... Anyway, so he eventually tries all these things in desperation, and she keeps coming back. Well, finally, he kills himself to escape from this. I mean, nothing's going to get rid of her, so he drinks poison, only to be, in the end, revived by the natives and united with her forever. Well, this was a particularly interesting story, because the writer, as far as I know, the writer is uncredited. And it looks, the artwork was done by Johnny Craig, which he did several of these books. But it's written in second person narrative. It starts out, well, just to read you an example, it starts out, you stand on the edge of the pier, staring anxiously out over the glittering, restless waters of the Caribbean Sea. You wipe the perspiration from your face, and then suddenly your heart skips a beat. You see it. I don't know about you, but I really can't stand it when something, especially a comic book, is written in second person. I don't know, it just sounds like a cheesy romance novel or something. Fairly amateur. So some other stories. The next one is The Ample Sample. And that one, oh, this is a good one. As I open it up here right in front of me, just to be reminded of the art. Irwin's wife, Hannah, quickly gets addicted to Whitman's candy sampler boxes after the two are married. Over the course of 10 years, Hannah becomes an overweight wench who spends all of Irwin's hard-earned savings on Whitman samplers. All of it. I mean, over the years, she just, you turn the pages and she gets fatter and fatter. And the husband has to beg her for things like socks and new jackets. But all she says is, "I spent it, Irwin! I wanted candy!" Well, eventually he does what any, even-minded person would do. And he turns her into a giant Whitman sampler-style treat. Basically what happens is, you see him on one page after he is... After his savings, he eventually tried to set aside some cash that she wouldn't get her hands on, and he goes, and then she finds it, spends all of it, and you see him in one panel with his eyes wide and a look of anger saying, "Hannah! Hannah!" And then the next page, she's divided into different, her guts are divided into different boxes, labeled, let's see, Lady Fingers, Forearm Fudge Combo, and Sour Bowels. And she's chopped all into little pieces, and it's just, oh gosh, it's just disgusting. Let's see, how did the, I can't see how the Comics Code ever found this. The next story is Ship Shape. This is your average standard ghost ship story. Basically, an airplane runs out of gas over the middle of the ocean, and it crashes. And there are four survivors, and then they get stranded on an inflatable life raft. After a few days, they come across a derelict ship covered with a strange fungus. They quickly realize that this fungus is a deadly living thing that can dissolve a human being like acid if its membrane is disturbed. So a couple of people die pretty quickly, and the others hop back onto the life raft in hopes of escape. They make it off, but not before some of the stuff infects the raft. Yeah, this was a good one. I personally love the ghost ship stories where, you know, you're stranded, and all of a sudden you find this ship in the middle of the ocean, and what you think is going to be your salvation actually ends up being a death trap. I especially like it when it's got some kind of weird alien or weird fungus that eats people. There was another story kind of like this, or this one kind of reminds me of a short Stephen King story called The Raft, where these four kids go swimming in this big lake, and there's this stationary raft in the middle of the lake. And they're trapped on it when they find out the lake is inhabited by this enormous fungus type thing that kind of floats along the surface and disintegrates any human that touches it. Pretty good stuff. So the artists of these stories, like I said, the writing has been largely uncredited, like many comic books of that day were. It was mainly just seen as the artist wrote it, the artist did the work on it, and the writers went uncredited. But some of the more notable names that you might recognize, or at least fans of older comics might recognize, are Jack Kamen, Wally Wood. Wally Wood's an extremely... He did a lot of the science fiction EC comics, like Weird Fantasy, Weird Science. And if I'm not mistaken, he committed suicide in 1980 or 81. Let's see, Harvey Kurtzman, Jack Davis. But most notable among all these famous historic comic book names is a man whose work I have remembered for ever since I started reading these. It's made a lasting impression on me, and I think you can see influences of his work even today. His name is Graham Ingalls, and he went by the nickname Ghastly. And you, if you ever look at these books, if you ever look at Graham Ingalls' work, you will realize why his nickname was Ghastly. The creepiness that he imbued his stories with goes unsurpassed to this day, in my opinion. Incredible amounts of detail. Every character is nuanced and unique. He employed a wide variety of angles, perspectives, and facial expressions, which kind of stood out among the other artists of that time period. But his if this man was a born horror comic book artist. I mean, he really knew his stuff. I mean, he draws, some of his stories involve walking corpses, and seriously, it looks like this guy went into a graveyard, dug up a coffin, and took a rotting body out and drew it, because, you know, it's that realistic. It's that affecting. It's very memorable. And two of my favorite stories I'm going to tell you about. One of them is called We Ain't Got Nobody. It's starts out with the rotting corpse of Henry, who's getting revenge from beyond the grave after three of his friends kill him for a large sum of money. They throw him off a train, and his body is torn apart. Although his torso is buried, the head, the hands, and the feet, which were torn apart in the train wreck, they work together, steal a mannequin, and find the men that killed him. One by one, the murderers meet gruesome ends. And it's just crazy because, you know, in the first few pages, it looks like this is all one person. As this creepy corpse of Henry is talking to his last victim, and he kind of recounts, he's narrating the story to the reader of the train wreck and everything. And then at the very end, we find out that it's really just the mannequin's body. And you see the hands and the head and the feet all digging, working together to reunite the rest of his body parts with the torso. It's pretty gruesome at the very end. And then another memorable one is called About Face, where a wealthy man's wife leaves him with twins. Only one of these twins he can never see. He's told that she is the one twin, her name is Olga, is too horrible to look at, and if he were to see her, he would hate her. The beautiful twin is Penny, and he only is allowed to see Penny, take Penny for walks, and all of that. Olga is cared for secretly by Penny, the housemaid, and the mother. Well, eventually the mother dies, and the father demands to see Olga. When he finally meets her, he is horrified, and it fails to establish a relationship with her. He tries to take her out, but eventually Olga realizes that he is embarrassed and horrified by her, and she threatens to leave him. In fact, Olga turns into something of a monster, and she attacks a couple of animals and a small child in her frustration. So the way the father sees it, he and Penny are trapped by this horrible person in the house. So to free her, the father decides to kill the ugly one. So he takes a gun upstairs and talks to Olga and tells her that he has to do this. They've got to get out of their life. So that she has to get out of their life some way. They have to be free. And he shoots her. He shoots her dead. And when she falls on the ground, before I tell you this, both sisters always wore these big bonnets over their heads. Everywhere they went, they wore these big bonnets. So when she falls, this bonnet falls off, and the other side of her head is revealed to be Penny. So he kills them both, and it was the one person the whole time. So if you ever read these books, they're fun to read. I mean, they they come across as fairly dated and fairly amateur in some respects. Not the artwork, probably more so the writing, but the artwork, especially by Graham Ingalls, is still still pretty creepy. But there was a definite theme in these books. There was always well, I think the authors had women issues, basically, because either the wife turns into a greedy hog who spends her savings on candy, or she would go out and cheat on the main characters, and there was always this vengeance thread that typically was about the woman. It was about getting revenge on the evil woman. So, good old 1950s sexist male-dominated stories there, but good stuff. You know, I just it's been a part of my comic book reading history for several years, so I just wanted to share that with you guys. Brian, do you have any good points to bring up?
I don't know. I've never actually read an EC comic. I'm familiar with the covers because I've seen them printed everywhere, but.
Especially the one with the guy holding the woman's
head. The guy holding the woman's decapitated head is probably the most famous one. But I was browsing through some of them you brought here, and they are, it is amazing that some of these
angles right there
actually were printed when they were.
Isn't it though?
I am kind of amazed.
How did they get away with that?
I don't know how they got away with it. I mean, it's just. It's just weird. It's just one of those weird things. You know, Marty has a copy of Seduction of the Innocent.
He does. I've seen that.
It is a good read.
Yeah. Well, you can understand where the parents were getting scared from, if you, especially with 1950s sensibilities. I mean, even now, you know, I would think parents would be a little uncomfortable with their kids reading stories about. Corpse, you know, somebody's wife
killing their wives and chopping them up and putting them in a big sampler box. Yeah,
the sampler
that would probably not be the best child reading.
Yeah.
So
kind of makes me wonder about the way I turned out from reading these things.
I don't wonder.
So yeah.
So this is Halloween. You know, time for some Halloween movies, and. You know, every year I always watch Halloween 1 and 2.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm actually not a big horror fan, but for some reason I like Halloween 1 and 2.
Because they're like the same, they're like two parts of the same movie. I like that.
I do like the cheesy Friday the 13th with Jason, and you know, Jason Takes Manhattan was a great one. Because it's just,
yeah, we might have to do that for B movie.
That wouldn't be a bad one. And of course, there's always the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown that I have to watch every year. It's part of tradition.
Do they have that on DVD yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, got that on DVD. So, I don't know. I was trying to think of any horror movies, Halloween movies that are coming out this month, but I don't know of any.
I don't know of any
I don't
either.
Keep up with them. Maybe that's why I don't.
They're also... stupid now because they all have the exact same plot. They all have, I mean, slasher flicks have always kind of had the group of beautiful teenagers getting killed off one by one.
Right.
But it seems like that's just all horror movies now. Like I watched a classic horror movie last night called The Fog. You know, Carpenter's The Fog. Great, great classic movie. A little slow by today's standards, but good story.
The Shining was on yesterday too.
The Shining too. Yeah. And they didn't have, you know, these young beautiful people acting in it, but it was still a good story. But now everything is just like J. Crew models running around getting slaughtered.
Isn't the world full of those people? Don't those people deserve to die?
There's too many of them.
I was trying to think if there was anything recently on TV because sometimes I'll be yesterday. Sci-Fi was showing a bunch of like. Movies I'd never seen, like Larva and like kind of your monster movie, like B movies, but I think they're kind of recent though. It was like made for TV, straight to crap movies.
Straight to crap.
But none of them are of the quality of Blackenstein.
No.
And for
no.
that, we can be thankful.
Yeah, Blackenstein is definitely still the worst.
Yeah, this is the worst movie I've ever seen, I think.
And between Brian and I, we have seen a lot of awful movies.
That one probably takes the cake
for
being the worst one. But do you have anything else?
I have a couple of funny things I saw this week. One of them is not comic book related. Have you ever heard of Liberty Money?
Liberty Money? No. Should
here's
I have?
Here's a picture of it right here. Okay, there's a school of thought out there that's... Well, it's not really a school of thought, but basically, there's plenty of people out there that are worried about our current economic situation, about the inflation of the American dollar and how it's not backed by any precious metal. It's not backed by gold or silver or anything anymore. It's been floating, and a lot of people, you know, say that that's the reason why we have so much inflation now, and, you know, our debt is just continually funded by China, and, you know, we're just an imbalance waiting to happen, basically, blah, blah, blah. So this guy, let's see, what was it? Bernard von Nothaus. He was the mint master at the Royal Hawaiian Mint. Basically, sometime, I guess it was in the late 90s when he started this, but he decided to make a currency backed with precious metal value, backed with gold or backed with silver, with the idea being that this actually had some kind of value. And you know how, you know, it's not there to replace the money of the U.S. federal government, the U.S. federal dollar. So it doesn't fall under counterfeit or anything, because it's not trying to say that it's the official currency of the United States. It's just another legal tender that you could exchange for goods and services if you were to agree with this with other businesses. It's mostly meant for local businesses
really?
And stuff like that. I'm not kidding you. Yeah, apparently.
Can you do that?
You can. It's not trying to be. I mean, it's not trying to act as the federal dollar, so it doesn't fall under counterfeit. In fact, somebody they had to defend themselves in court because somebody said they were counterfeiting, and the lawsuit was won on their side saying they weren't because it wasn't pretending to be the U.S. dollar. But basically, it's meant for more local level economy, like your farmers market. Some of the farmers that we go to use it with other farmers because you know, they like using it. They like having a legal tender that isn't regulated by the United States, but that isn't open to inflation and price changes and all these other things that they are concerned about. So I just thought that was a neat little thing. It's kind of like, you know how the United States Postal Service isn't the only game in town,
right?
That's regulated by the government, but we also have FedEx, which competes with that, which does a better job. We've got UPS. So these things compete with the federal government for something that we generally think of as government regulated, like mail. But it doesn't have to be used by the government. Just as citizens, as free citizens, we should not have to use just what the government gives us and have them mismanage. At least that's the mindset. I'm not saying I agree with it or that I own any of it or anything like that, but I do think it's an interesting concept.
So if me and you decided to start using Monopoly money, we could do that.
If we decided that value was attached to Monopoly money, you and I and we got a group of people to exchange this, theoretically we could. However, Monopoly money is not backed by any sort of value whatsoever. There's no gold
yet
or anything attached to it.
That is weird.
That's kind of strange.
That is the weirdest thing I've heard in a long time.
I thought that was interesting enough for to mention on the show. So yeah, it's called the American Liberty Dollar. They have a website you can check out, americanlibertydollar.org, and you can read about this.
Libertydollar.org.
Just libertydollar.org. And apparently 100,000 people at least are using this sort of exchange of currency now. And it's just kind of neat. And mind if I
sure
tell them? Got another quick point. I was looking at a libertarian website.
Things were slow at work this week.
I was looking at a libertarian website, not looking for a comic book, and I saw an advertisement for something called the Probability Breach. The Probability Breach is a graphic novel from L. Neil Smith and Scott Beiser. You can find it online at www.bigheadpress.com. And basically, it's kind of like a religious tract, only it's for libertarianism. Which libertarianism, if you guys aren't familiar with, is basically the the idea of that a free society works best when government regulates the least, where government isn't involved in all of your day-to-day decisions, when there isn't this huge bureaucracy looking over everything. It's basically much closer to what the Constitution kind of calls for. That, you know, kind of calls for in the limited government. And this is kind of like a tract for it. It's about this guy who he's in this dark future where everything is regulated by the government. You can't own anything unless the government says you can. You aren't allowed to own weapons. You aren't really allowed to own property. Everything is essentially owned by the government in some form or fashion. And this guy is a cop investigating a murder of someone who is a part of a propertarian, who is basically like a libertarian, but they're in this little group called propertarians, and he's investigating one of their murders. And it leads him into this worldwide conspiracy, I suppose, and he's chased by agents of this government conspiracy. As he's investigating this murder, he's chased by these agents into a paradise where history kind of went different from where it had in his reality. History veered towards less government involvement in life, or less authority in general, I guess. It's almost anarchistic, and I just thought that was kind of neat. He visits this paradise where people are much happier and society runs freer because things are privatized and stuff. I just thought that was an interesting read. So and it's all online now. If I'm not mistaken, they're putting it all. It was just a graphic novel, and now they're putting it all online at the website www.bigheadpress.com, and you can look for that. So hey, yeah. I thought that was kind of neat.
Is that a monkey?
That is a smoking. No, not a smoking monkey. But yes, that is a monkey. There is a monkey somewhere in this.
Well, okay.
But I thought the art actually wasn't. I mean, it was kind of slightly amateurish. But overall, I've seen a lot worse. That's interesting. It was pretty neat. Kind of grabbed my attention.
All right. Well, I don't have anything else this week. If you want some money, print some up and connect it with some sort of precious metal, and you and your friends can start your own economy. And if we've done nothing else this week, let's do that. This is Brian Shearer. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at brian@gravyboy.com. If you want to get in touch with Andy, you can email him at
andy@gravyboy.com.
And thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Take it easy.